With him are his three oldest sons. Why don't you take a stab at how to pronounce those names?
Elendur, Aratan, and Kirion.
Yeah, yeah. I gave them to you because they were easy.
Okay,
All right, Cooper, we're back again.
Indeed we are.
How are you doing?
Doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good, pretty good. We haven't caught up in a bit because we haven't been doing endings to episodes yet. But yeah, how are you doing?
Spring is in the air.
Yeah.
Got a second vaccine on the way. Super busy with work, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, other than that, things are good.
Nice.
Dude. Hoping for a little summer travel soon.
Yeah. Dude, I finally downloaded Audible.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's I've been holding out for a solid at least 3 years because I didn't think it was all that, but kind of is. Yeah, because you get the you get like the credit and you can trade in the credit pretty easily. But then in addition to that, there's a bunch of other free books that you can download and stuff. And so I paid for Matthew McConaughey Green Lights because if you're ever going to audiobook something, it's him reading it, you know, his own autobiography. But that was very good. And then I went back because I don't think I had ever fully read it when I was a kid. Listen to Tom Sawyer. Hilarious. Oh. Hilarious book.
Nice.
Everything about it was so funny. Like Mark Twain lives up to the hype. Oh man.
Yeah, I haven't touched that or read anything from that since school.
So, not to spoil anything, everybody knows the whitewash fence at the beginning where he gets all the other kids to pay him to wash his own fence, you know, because he makes it look so much fun. The stuff that they pay him in is ridiculous. You know, there's marbles, but then it's fish hooks, a dead cat. You know? I mean, it's just the most random assortment of things possible. Yeah, it was pretty good. But yeah. All right, well, that was enough of that. What are we doing today?
We've got another special, and we are covering a few things. The Last Alliance and Isildur, basically. But in big picture, we're stitching together our narrative from Numenor, which we left off with last time, all the way into Gondor to cue up the start of Return of the King.
Right, right, right. Yeah, so we're going to handle the Last Alliance tonight and then the death of Isildur, because we got an account of it in Unfinished Tales somewhere. So, yeah. I guess no Cliff's Notes tonight. Man, you haven't done Cliff's Notes in a while.
Yeah, I've been gone off pretty easy.
All right. Okay, so anyways. Well, no. How about you Cliff's Notes Numenor? And seriously, keep it under 90 seconds.
Oh, man. Okay, so Numenor... Back in Sumerian days, the war against Morgoth, some of the tribes of men fight on the good guy's side with the elves. They fight so well that the Valar decide to reward them by giving them an island that they raise up out of the ocean. It's two-thirds of the way between Middle-earth and Valinor. The men are there. They form a great kingdom. Everything is really great. And then they start to get antsy, and they start to want to sail west towards Valinor instead of just east back towards Middle-earth. But the gods tell them they're not allowed to, and eventually they're kind of corrupted with Sauron's help. They try to sail west to Valinor, eventually invading it, and the gods get really angry and basically destroy it and sink it. And a very small number of them escape that destruction and make it back to Middle Earth.
Yeah. And the world becomes round.
Yes, the entire world is reformed in the process of the island getting sunk back right. into the sea.
And Sauron actually drowned with the island, but since he's a Maiar, he was able to escape, but he could no longer put on a sly snake oil salesman fair appearance. He's now just an evil guy for good.
And it became physically impossible for mortal men to sail and find Valinor. And now it got put in some sort of time warp where it's still in the world, but not in the world anymore.
Yeah. And that was a really, it was like Atlantis is what that story really ended up kind of being like, or what Tolkien was trying to harmonize, you know, give a good legend that could serve as that basically. Yeah. All right. Cool. So who was the leader of those good guys that made it back to Middle Earth?
Elendil.
Yep. Okay. So these were nobles because they were descendants. They were a lesser branch of the early kings, you know, but then they became kind of lords of something else. So they have noble blood in them. And so Elendil's the person that leads them back. So they get all tossed about the sea as that island was destroyed, and it was the worst storm ever. And so Elendil lands up north in Lindon, which is where it's kind of like the gray. It's right near the Gray Havens, you know. So everybody just get out the Lord of the Rings map now. Us too.
One second.
You don't have it on you? So if we cue off where the Shire is, everybody should know where the Shire is. If you go west, you get to the Gray Havens. And so then there's those, the Gray Havens is in the gap of the mountains. And then past the mountains, there's two forms of land. I don't know, what would you kind of call those? Plateau of land before a beach.
All right, okay. So go from the Shire and then where?
West to Gray Havens.
Okay, west to Gray Havens, yeah.
All right, and so then Gray Havens is kind of in a gap of a mountain range, right? The Arid Luin, which is the Blue Mountains. So there's still some spits of land on the other side of the Blue Mountains. What would you call that? Like a plateau? Or not really a plateau, but...
Like coastal plain or something?
Yeah, yeah. So anyways, that's where Gil-galad and Elrond for a time hung out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where Elendil lands. And so when he gets there, he decides... he's already pals with Gil-galad because Gil-galad was always helping out the Elendil's ancestors because they were always the good guys of Numenor because the good guys of Numenor had helped fight Sauron before in the early wars when he had first made the ring. So, looking at this map, Elendil passes through the mountains to like the Gray Havens, and so that whole area between the Arid Luin mountain range and the Misty mountain range at the end, that's Eriador. So it's kind of like its own subcontinent, kind of... Mm-hmm. I mean, India is a better subcontinent, but that's what we mean when we say subcontinent. India is a subcontinent of Asia. So think something like that. And so what he does is he sets up a chief city of Anumios right above the Shire. So if you look where the Shire is, you can still see it on my map, at least like kind of right above it on that lake. Do you see it?
Yes.
Nanuial Lake. Lake Evendom?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, okay. I see it real tiny. And Numenius.
Yeah, yeah. So now, I mean, by the time of Lord of the Rings, that city's abandoned. Now, of course, the Shire wasn't actually functioning yet. That wasn't a thing. The Hobbits were still over the Misty Mountains. They hadn't migrated to the Shire yet. So
Right.
We're just using that as a reference because it's the easiest thing to explain this map. Another big city was Fornost. And so that's actually that's the furthest north, basically, of the Shire itself. I don't think it's technically in the Shire, but that's near the North Downs. And so that's basically about the northern part of this kingdom as well. And then the eastern border is near the Gray Haven. That's got to be the western border. Oh, man, Clifford, I screwed up. I mixed up east and west.
Ooh.
It's because I'm from the United States. Oh, I typed it out wrong again. All right. So the westernmost border is those Tower Hills that are on the far downs, the White Downs, right near the Gray Havens. So that's there's three big towers that they built. And Actually, no, Gil-Glad had built those towers before, but I think he kind of gives them to men to rule, I guess. He gives them to Elendil because they're buds. And then the southern provinces, do you see the word Cardolan on the map? So that's the southern province of it. It's below the South Downs, so below the Shire.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
So that's the southernmost province. And then there's Ruardor. How would you pronounce that? Ruhardor?
Rudar?
Rudar. All right, so Rudar is the westernmost part, and then it starts to approach towards Rivendell and the Misty Mountains. Sorry, easternmost part. I get this always screwed up. Easternmost part near Rivendell, near the Misty Mountains. This encompasses potentially Weathertop, or Weathertop's the disputed border thing between all of it. But then, you know, remember that last bridge that they had to cross when they were making their way to Rivendell, and they crossed probably the ford where the cool horsey waterfall came up, sent by Elrond.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the border, you know, the last border. And then beyond that, there's Elrond's area. Mm-hmm. All right, so this was a whole kingdom in the north, okay? Let's see. So these people, they built Weathertop, you know, that was called Amon-Sul. They built all the barrows that we saw way back in book one as well. This place was called Arnor. Oh, shoot. Did I not delete anything? Oh, Clifford, you have all my notes again. All right, don't look. Don't look. Don't look. I know I just told you you have all my notes. What do you think Arnor means?
Men of the North.
Oh, good guess. Good guess. Okay. Shockingly, I could not find an explanation. I thought, you know, linguistic explanation would be clearly written for this one. So, here's my guess. Taking apart the parts, or the syllables, R, where do we already see R?
Oh, in the names of the kings in Numenor, like Ar-Pharazôn.
Right,
and,
yeah.
Yeah.
And what did it mean again?
King, yeah. Or presumably okay. Some sort of ruler.
Yeah. Right, so R has to be king, right? And then Nor, so this is where it might be a stretch, but I think Nor might be a variant of Dor. Because Dor, like Mordor or Gondor, means land. Mm. I know it means land. So maybe Nor is just a softer variant of it, you know, like a smoother variant. And so maybe it just means king's land.
Oh, interesting.
That's my guess. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe you're right, but maybe I'm right. Or maybe we're both wrong. I don't know. Yeah. All right. Okay. So we got Arnor in the north.
I'm surprised in all of his writing, Tolkien wouldn't.
I know. I was
written that down of all things.
Right. When I say shocking, I mean wow. That's actually shocking that I couldn't quickly find a source of this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So meanwhile, Isildur and Onarion, they land further south and they set up Gondor. Now, as I said, Dor is land. Gon is stone. So it's just stone land. So they're gonna get stone land because they build so many monuments of big stone, as we've encountered already. We've seen most of them, actually. All right, so if you look at the map, the mouth of Anduin, you know, Anduin was the river that the Fellowship sailed down, so we know that one pretty well. But we can go to the close looking map now, you know, like the just Gondor Mordor map. Yeah, that'll do us
map
well.
Number four. Oh, no,
Zoom. Yeah, there's the super one. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Let's see. So they landed at Anduin, sailed up the mouth of that. Now, if we remember from the Numenor specials that we did, the good Numenorians had already built a big, huge tower at Pelargir, all right, which is seems like it's a couple, I don't know, leagues up the river, about, 2/5 of the way to Minas Tirith from the mouth, would you say? It's right on the folder page.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. That's about right.
Yeah. Okay, so that tower is already there. But then from there, it sounds like there's already some faithful Numenorians that had kind of a colony here, or a permanent colony here. So they welcome the Sons of Elendil. They build the chief city of Osgiliath on the river. Anybody that's seen the movies knows that city, but it's right basically in what's common Gondor proper, you know, what we think of when we think of Gondor. So it's pretty far up the river, in between the Ethel Duath, which is the Mordor range, which is where Minas Morgul sits, and then on the other side of the river valley, there's the White Mountains, and that's Mount Mindoluin, which is where Minas Tirith is built. But, of course, both those names were not the original names. Minas Ithil was the one that was on the Mordor border, and that's the Tower of the Rising Moon. And then Minas Anor, which I always say Arnor just because I'm, you know, it looks so close, but it's Anor. Minas Anor was what Minas Tirith was, and that's the Tower of the Setting Sun. Because I always thought that was weird that the western one was the Tower of the Sun, but it's the Tower of the Setting Sun. You know, so that makes sense. Whereas Minas Ithil, Tower of the Rising Moon, I think the moon, where the moon rises doesn't, it's not always east. So I don't know.
Okay.
More to be desired on that one, I guess. But so anyways, Isildur lived in Minas Ithil. His brother Anarion lived in Minas Arnor. And then they both jointly ruled Gondor together. And they had two thrones side by side in Osgiliath. Now, apparently at this time, they built the Argonath, you know, which they famously pass in Lord of the Rings. It's one of the best scenes of the Fellowship. And so those are the two statues of Isildur and Anarion, which I have to say is a pretty bold move to have built in your own lifetime.
Yeah, agreed.
No, no humility problem there, or, you know, meekness.
There's a lot of comparisons of the Gondor folks to basically the classical empires, like the Greeks and Romans, and maybe a little bit the Egyptians, and that feels very much in keeping with those.
Yeah. This is I mean, you were right with the Egyptians. I mean, that is
For the Numenoreans,
right? Well, and then the Gondorians too, as we'll see.
Okay.
Though there's a couple other examples, but we're not going to get into that tonight. I don't think there's too many historical references tonight. We were pretty on fire with the last part, I have to say, in the last episode.
Good.
With all the Nazi architecture and the who is supposed to be buried in the sphere thing?
Oh, Newton's cenotaph.
Newton. Yeah. Okay, so they also build Orthanc and Isengard, and then there's some sort of reference that they do something at Aglarond, which I believe are the Helm's Deep caves, but I didn't quite understand what the hell they were referring to. And then they build something at a place called Erech, which we haven't been to yet, but just keep that in mind. Keep that in mind when we go to Return of the King.
Okay.
Many treasures and great heirlooms of virtue and wonder the exiles had brought from Numenor. And of these, the most renowned were the Seven Stones and the White Tree. All right, the White Tree is obvious, right? What is that? What do we remember from Numenor?
The White Tree was growing at the center of the palace, basically, right? And it kind of paralleled the lineage of the kings.
Yeah.
And after Sauron corrupted Ar-Pharazôn, he convinced him to cut it down, even though the prophecy said that that would end the line of the kings.
Yeah.
So, meanwhile, Elendil's son?
Yes.
Elendil's son Isildur very daringly went and stole a fruit off the tree, right, and planted it anew. Mm-hmm. So they have a little sapling of the White Tree.
Right, but now, he's the one that owns Minas Ithil, which is what becomes Minas Morgul. So he actually plants the White Tree there, which is like, But anyways, just keep that in mind.
Okay.
What are the Seven Stones?
The seven stones, I only knew because you mentioned this at the end of the last episode, are the Palantiri.
Yep. Right? Yep.
Which are the seeing stones, which we've gotten a little glimpse of in the Two Towers.
Right. Yeah. So Elendil has three of the stones, and then the two sons each have two. Okay. So that will get to our seven. Should we go through and play around? Where are all seven?
Okay. Sure. Where are they?
Okay. Well, take a guess. All right, let's do the Gondor ones first, because that's easy. There's four down in Gondor.
Wait, okay. You just said that
they split them up.
Has three.
Right.
The sons have two.
Okay, two each, And the sons are in Gondor.
Okay, Isildur and Anarion. Okay, gotcha. So I bet one's going to be at Minas Anor, which is...
becomes Minas Tirith,
One's going to be at Minas Ithil, which becomes Minas Morgul,
right? Yep.
Probably one's at Osgiliath.
Okay, good. So that's three.
And maybe one is at this other place you mentioned, Eric or something.
Ah, come on, Clifford. Think back to Two Towers.
Isengard?
Yeah. That's how Saruman got it. Yeah. It was just okay, always already. There. Yeah, okay.
Oh, interesting. All right. Okay.
All right. Fair. And then what about the three in the north? This is a little bit harder.
Weathertop?
Oh, good guess, unless you read the note.
No.
Okay.
Good. Let's see. I feel like it's going to be like the two other towns you mentioned or something.
Well, it's not Fornos, so what were the other things?
What was it called? Annuminas?
Yeah. Okay, so one was there because that was his capital.
Okay.
And then was the last one?
Ooh. Let's see. The Far Downs? Something near there?
Where are the Far Downs again? Yep, good guess. It was in the Tower Hills. Yep.
Okay. Oh, I see.
So, let's see.
Tower Hills, Annuminas, and Weathertop?
Yep.
All right.
Yeah, so that last one's the coolest. Now, let me read this quote about it. Now, these stones had this virtue that all those who looked therein might perceive in them things far off, whether in place or in time. For the most part, they revealed only things near to another kindred stone. For the stones each called to each. But those who possessed great strength of will and of mind might learn to direct their gaze whither they would. Thus, the Numenoreans were aware of many things that their enemies wished to conceal, and little escaped their vigilance in the days of their might. All right, now of the Tower Hills one specifically, because like I just said, this is the coolest one. Thither, Elendil... Thither. All right, we're getting our thithers in.
Thither?
Thither, Elendil would repair. Instead of rest, we're saying repair.
Uh-huh.
And thence he would gaze out over the sundering seas when the yearning of exile was upon him. And it is believed that thus he would at whiles see far away even the Tower of Avalone upon Eresia, where the Master Stone abode. And yet abides. These stones were gifts of the Eldar to Amandil, father of Elendil, for the comfort of the faithful of Numenor in their dark days. Pretty cool.
Mm. So in other words, first of all, I was like, when you're like, and yet abides. I was like, yes, the dude does abide. But that's implying that he's seeing maybe an eighth Palantir.
Yeah, it seems like it's an eighth.
That's sitting at Avalone, which is like the gateway to Valinor, right?
The Eresia is the Lonely Isle, so the Lonely Isle is with Valinor just right offshore. It's the Lonely Island.
It's like the first thing you hit, right? Yep. Before you hit Valinor.
Yeah.
But that we know that part of the world was like formed out of the world's roundness.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it kind of isn't there in the world anymore, yet somehow he's seeing it.
Well, because of the stones, yeah. Pretty cool detail, because the Tower Hills, it's like, talk about a place of mysticism, you know, mm-hmm. and talk about peak nostalgia for the guy that grew up on Numenor and his island was destroyed, and now he can see the better version of it that's still around but completely inaccessible. Big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Love Lord of the Rings. This is what it's all about. All right, so quietly after Arnor and Gondor are set up, Sauron comes back to Middle-earth because he was, you know, basically drowned in the downfall of Numenor. So this is when he builds or rebuilds Barad-dûr, the big dark tower. That's all that Barad-dûr means is dark tower, with the great eye on it, okay? You want to take that that paragraph about Sauron?
Now Sauron prepared war against the Eldar and the men of Westernes, and the fires of the mountain were wakened again. Wherefore, seeing the smoke of Uruk-ruin from afar, and perceiving that Sauron had returned, the Numenoreans named that mountain anew Amon-Amarth, which is Mount Doom. And Sauron gathered to him great strength of his servants out of the east and the south, and among them were not a few of the high race of Numenor. For in the days of the sojourn of Sauron in that land, the hearts of well-nigh all its people had been turned towards darkness. Therefore, many of those who sailed east in that time, and made fortresses and dwellings upon the coasts were already bent to his will, and they served him still gladly in Middle-earth. But because of the power of Gil-galad, these renegades, lords both mighty and evil, for the most part took up their abodes in the southlands far away. Yet two there were, Herumor and Fuinir, who rose to power among the Haradrim, a great and cruel people that dwelt in the wide lands south of Mordor beyond the mouths of the Anduin.
All right, so what do you think of that?
Sounds like, so Sauron's back, he's making war, but...
It's what he does, you know, as yes. you do, as he yeah, does.
He's ready to cause trouble, and isn't really biding his time either. He doesn't seem too scared anymore. He was real cautious before about the strength of the Numenoreans, but he seems now kind of unfazed.
Well, that's because, I mean, this is only a fraction of what was there in the Golden Age. And the Golden Age he corrupted at its peak, yeah. you know.
You'd think he lost his physical form in a way.
Well,
he'd be a little bit tempered, but
in some
ways it doesn't matter.
Right. I agree with you. Besides that, when he went and bowed down to Ar-Pharazôn to come back with him as a prisoner, maybe he just made sure everything was pretty A-okay set up. So when he gets back, it's just, all right, it's time.
He's like, orcs, close the shutters, please.
Yeah. All right, make sure the doors are locked.
Yeah.
Make sure the milk doesn't go bad. I'll be back soon, and then we're going.
Make sure you close the lid to Mount Doom. No, anyways. The other interesting thing here is, sounds like the Numenoreans are about to be fighting their own ancestors.
Right.
It sounds like the ones who sailed from Numenor back when it was big and powerful and still above sea level made these settlements all over Middle-earth, right?
Right.
All over the place. And a lot of them were in this... the undefined south and east lands, and the ones who were living there, once Sauron started kind of spreading his tendrils, got corrupted over to his side. So now the new sort of refugees of the destruction of Numenor sound like they're about to come head to head with their older ancestors who are now fighting for Sauron.
Right. Yeah, we had said there was some detail in the Akalabeth, which is the fall of Numenor that we were using for the past 3 weeks, that three of the rings of men, went to bad Numenoreans that were still left on the coast. I don't know if you remember that detail, because it kind of didn't quite fit with the story's timeline. But anyways, it was referenced, you know. Mm-hmm. And it should be said, too, for these details about the Last Alliance, it's all in the Rings of Power, which is the very last story in the Silmarillion. So just FYI, when we quote stuff, that's where it's coming from. So as you said, lots of men are evil, fighting for Sauron. Sauron's got all his armies and stuff, so he's pretty on the move. First thing he does, because he launches war on Gondor right away, Gondor's the neighbor, he basically, it seems like he takes over Minas Ithil, no problem. Isildur has to flee with his family, and he flees with the seedling of the tree, too, because he had planted it there. Again, it must be kind of weird facing Sauron, too, because he had cordially met him back in Numenor, you know? Kind of like how Melkor had hung out in Valinor before, you know, like eventually Fingolfin. Fingolfin had met him in Valinor, and then one day he finally sees him again in Middle-earth, and they're fighting to the death, you know. So it's kind of the same with Isildur and Sauron, which is nuts. But yeah, so Isildur and his family, they escape from Minas Ithil, and they sail down the Anduin, and then they sail around to the north of Middle-earth seeking out their dad, because they obviously had word that he had set up Arnor in the north. And so then he leaves his brother Anarion to hold down the fort, basically, at Osgiliath, okay? Okay. So, now, Elendil and Gil-galad form the famous Last Alliance when they get word from Isildur. And so, I don't know if this was called the Last Alliance at the time, like they knew this would be the last one or something, or if this is kind of a backlog name like World War One, where it was called the Great War, but then once World War Two was there, then they called it World War One. You know? So, maybe it was just the Alliance, but now...
So, you're saying, like, it could have been the Last Alliance until... a new alliance was formed, and then they were like, this is the fourth alliance.
Or No.
It'd be like...
Oh, well, that's an idea, too.
The third alliance or something?
That's an idea, too. No, I was just thinking they called it the alliance, but then 1,000 years later, when men and elves no longer talk to each other, they then started calling it the last alliance, because it's like, oh, we're never going to ally with these people again. They're nuts. Oh,
okay. Gotcha.
You know, because elves and men stop being friends after this. Until Lord of the Rings time. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Let's see.
But anyways, so Elendil is up in the north, right? So yeah. even though Isildur went to sail up there, Elendil and Gil-galad, who's the kind of lead elf of that region.
Yep.
They're on their way back.
Who is Gil-galad again? Do you
remember? Gil-galad is, I know I'm not going to be able to describe his biography well. Notably, though, we came across him when the hobbits were on their way out of the Shire.
Right. Yeah.
And he was leading a group of elves west to the Great Havens.
Yeah, so Gil-galad, it depends which family tree you look at. If you look at the Wikipedia stuff, it's got the most updated thing that I don't really like that really happened at the very end of Tolkien's life. I usually go with the standard one that's in the Silmarillion itself. So Gil-galad is the son of Fingon, who's the son of Fingolfin. Okay, so this is Fingolfin's grandson, which is pretty cool. Yeah, so he's the leader of the elves. And then if he's related to Fingon, Fingon's brother was Turgon. From Turgon, you go down to Idril. From Idril, you go down to Earendil. From Earendil, you go down to Elrond, who's also hanging out with Gil-galad. You know, Elrond learned everything he knows from Gil-galad, basically.
So Gil-galad's his uncle? Or like second uncle or whatever? One generation up and a family tree over?
I think two generations up. Because he's...
Okay.
Yeah. He would be Arendil's uncle once over.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair.
Yeah, so Arendil's second cousin, I believe, and then yeah.
Anyways, yeah. he's a big deal guy,
right?
With ties to the early days,
right? It's him and Galadriel and Elrond that are the big deal elves at this point. So, the last alliance is formed. They marched east into Middle-earth, gathering a great host of elves and men, and they halted for a while at Imladris, that's Rivendell. It is said that the host that was there assembled was fairer and more splendid in arms than any that has since been seen in Middle-earth, and none greater has been mustered since the host of the Valar went against Thangorodrim. So that's the War of Wrath when Arendil was there. From Imladris, they crossed the Misty Mountains by many passes and marched down the River Anduin, and so came at last upon the hosts of Sauron on Daggerlad, the battle plain, which lies before the gate of the Black Land. All right, so do we know where we're at? Daggerland? Mm-hmm. Dagger means battle, and then I guess lad means plain. I guess if we're going by that. All right, so where's the Daggerlad?
This is the dead marshes that Frodo and Sam and... mind blank.
Gollum.
Where Frodo, Sam, and Gollum walked through.
Yes. Right? All right. So at this point, I believe what we talked about in Lord of the Rings was the Dead Marshes were expanding. So originally the Dead Marshes were smaller. So this was just, it's not like it was good ground, but it was solid ground as opposed to a marsh. Mm-hmm. But yeah, now the Dead Marshes have kind of seeped over at least a good portion of this battlefield, because you know that's where all the graves are turning up now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing about marsh is that stuff doesn't decay, so that's why the graves are incorrupted there. So yeah, it's basically in front of Mordor, in front of the Black Gate, or a couple days journey away from the Black Gate. So this is where the big epic battlefield was. Nice wide plain, as it says. Yeah. Let's see. Yeah, so if you're looking at the map, that's kind of easy to find where the Black Gate is, you know, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you want to take the next thing about Gil-galad?
The host of Gil-galad and Elendil had the victory, for the might of the elves was still great in those days, and the Numenoreans were strong and tall and terrible in their wrath. Against Aglos, the spear of Gil-galad, none could stand, and the sword of Elendil filled orcs and men with fear, for it shone with the light of the sun and of the moon, and it was named Narsil. Then Gil-galad and Elendil passed into Mordor and encompassed the stronghold of Sauron, and they laid siege to it for 7 years, and suffered grievous loss by fire and by the darts and bolts of the enemy, and Sauron sent many sorties against them. There in the valley of Gorgoroth, Anarion, son of Elendil, was slain, and many others.
All right, so there's no details about how they won the Daggerlad battle. You know, it doesn't say anything about any cool fight moves that happened, any famous, you know, sorties or raids or something. It just all happens at once and the good guys win, which is pretty damn cool. Think it, you know, just because it doesn't have details about it doesn't mean it wasn't an epic battle. This is up there in probably top three biggest battles in the history of Middle-earth, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, after that, though, they still have to go all the way into Mordor, you know, kind of almost inch by inch is what it seems, because it takes them 7 years to siege this place out. And I'm almost...
Sounds brutal.
Yeah, I'm almost wondering, too, I don't know if they did that in shifts where it's just, yeah, you can go home, spend a month with your family, and then come back to the front lines. It might just be, nah, we're here. We're going to sit in Mordor for 7 years, you know, to try to root them out. I don't know what they did. But, yeah, so eventually they get... They basically have the whole Dark Tower surrounded, but they just can't get into it. And so if I remember right, because it didn't say it in the story, but I believe Anarion, he gets killed because some sort of boulder crushes him, because I think they were just throwing him off the tower and he was pretty close to the gate or something. And mm-hmm. I think he gets crushed. So it's a bummer way to go. But also he was a valiant warrior, you know, and
mm-hmm.
he dies a hero, unlike a certain brother by the end of the special.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. All right. But at last the siege was so straight that Sauron himself came forth, and he wrestled with Gil-galad and Elendil, and they both were slain. And the sword of Elendil broke under him as he fell. But Sauron also was thrown down, and with the hilt shard of Narsil, Isildur cut the ruling ring from the hand of Sauron and took it for his own. Then Sauron was for that time vanquished, and he forsook his body, and his spirit fled far away and hid in waste places, and he took no visible shape again for many long years. All right, that's the famous scene, right? This is what starts off the movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would have to say the movies, based on that passage, they did a pretty good job because it is kind of ambiguous. But apparently Gil-galad and Elendil were fighting with Sauron 1v2. And Sauron kills both of them, I guess. You know, is what it seems how it goes down. And then Isildur...
Wait a second. I thought we met Gil-galad later on, though.
No, it's the last alliance. We all walked in together.
But don't we see Gil-galad in the Lord of the Rings?
No. That's Curdian, right. I think you're thinking of.
Who did...
Oh, you're thinking of Gildur.
Oh, okay, sorry. I got confused for a second. All right. No, you're absolutely right.
I know.
That's yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, Gil-galad gets killed. This is where he gets killed. Because Sam sings it. You were thinking of Gildur, but we had already heard of Gil-galad because Sam had sung one of the songs about him on the way to Rivendell. And it was surprising mm-hmm. that he knew it. And they were at Weathertop or near Weathertop when he was singing it. And so it's, I don't know, it was pretty fitting. Because that's where Elendil and Gil-galad had rendezvoused to walk down together. Anyways, Isildur, when he cuts the ring. All right, so that's the thing with the movie. What's his face? Elendil gets killed and the sword breaks. Then Isildur goes over there and he takes the broken, you know, he's laying down somehow because he was fighting Sauron, but Sauron knocks him down. And so Isildur's laying down and the sword hilt is right there. So he grabs it and he just flings it across the air because for some reason, Sauron's reaching out his hand with the ring hand, okay? Now, why he's reaching out the hand? Is he trying to pick up Isildur to, like, stare him in the face before he kills him or something? Or, you know, it's not explained at all. So I think what would make more sense is if Isildur really just had the shard of Narsil, because something happened to his own sword or he fell away. And so with the shard, he managed to just kind of get a hack towards Sauron while he's holding his weapon. But what he hacks instead of the weapon itself is just the fingers, you know, holding the weapon, and one of those is the ring finger, and then he ends up cutting that off. I think that would be more reasonable, but I still thought the movie did a pretty good job, and it was a pretty epic opening, you know.
Agreed.
And I don't think anybody could really crap on that one, as even though there are other parts that we have been critical of. You want to take that next paragraph?
Thus began the third age of the world, after the eldest days and the black years, and there was still hope in that time and the memory of mirth. And for long, the white tree of the Eldar flowered in the courts of the kings of men. For the seedling which he had saved, Isildur planted in the citadel of Anor, in memory of his brother, ere he departed from Gondor. The servants of Sauron were routed and dispersed, yet they were not wholly destroyed. And though many men turned now from evil and became subjects to the heirs of Elendil, yet many more remembered Sauron in their hearts and hated the kingdoms of the West. The Dark Tower was leveled to the ground, yet its foundations remained, and it was not forgotten. The Numenoreans indeed set a guard upon the land of Mordor, but none dared dwell there because of the terror of the memory of Sauron, and because of the mountain of fire that stood nigh to Barad-dûr, and the valley of Gorgoroth was filled with ash. Many of the elves and many of the Numenoreans and of men who were their allies had perished in the battle and the siege, and Elendil the Tall and Gilgalad the High King were no more. Never again was such a host assembled, nor was there any such league of elves and men, for after Elendil's day, the two kindreds became estranged.
Okay. What do you think of that?
I mean, big deal. That's transitioning of an entire age. It's like, doesn't happen very often. Right. So there's a lot going on there. But so at the specific level, this seems pretty explicit. Like, they got rid of the bad thing, but they didn't rip out its roots.
Right. As we know from Lord of the Rings, obviously.
Right. Something bad is still on the horizon.
Yeah.
And then this whole thing about the elves and men becoming estranged, which you alluded to before, sounds like actually a really big deal.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Elendil was maybe holding everything together by himself. Like, he was the last of the elf friends on Numenor, resisting the king and kind of befriending the elves. And then without him acting as, like, diplomat, they just... everything disintegrated or something.
Let's circle back to that for our next one, because Arnor's near Rivendell, right? So mm-hmm. We'll see how much contact they have with him during that point.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it's a big deal because this definitely sets the stage, and obviously, you know, the movie scene too, but so something kind of happened with it, or I'm about to read it actually. Isildur, you know, Elrond said, dude, get rid of the ring now, you know. And so potentially did that lead to some sort of spark the estrangement? Potentially, maybe, who knows? Not sure. Let's take this straight into Isildur. The ruling ring passed out of the knowledge even of the wise in that age, yet it was not unmade. For Isildur would not surrender it to Elrond and Círdan, who stood by. They counseled him to cast it into the fire of Orodruin, nigh at hand, in which it had been forged, so that it should perish, and the power of Sauron be forever diminished, and he should remain only as a shadow of malice in the wilderness. But Isildur refused this counsel, saying, "This I will have as Wyrgild for my father's death and my brother's. Was it not I that dealt the enemy his death blow? And the ring that he held seemed to him exceedingly fair to look on, and he would not suffer it to be destroyed. Taking it, therefore, he returned at first to Minas Anor, and there planted the white tree in memory of his brother Anarion. But soon he departed, and after he had given counsel to Meneldil, his brother's son, and had committed to him the realm of the south, he bore away the ring to be an heirloom of his house, and marched north from Gondor by the way that Elendil had come. And he forsook the South Kingdom, for he purposed to take up his father's realm in Eriador, far from the shadow of the Black Land." So, what happened? He keeps the ring. He gives Gondor to his nephew Meneldil, which is Anarion's son, and then he books it north to Arnor, which is, you know, in the subcontinent of Eriador, you know, and the Shire is basically kind of the heart of that realm, actually. All right, so from here, we transition out of the Rings of Power, and we go into the Unfinished Tales. How are we doing on time? Oh, we're taking forever. Well, not forever, but too slow. All right, so Isildur, he took from his dad, Elendil, he took the Elendil Mir. What'd you think of this thing? I thought this was pretty cool.
That's the crown, right?
Yeah,
that's
the jewel. Well, it's not really even a crown. It's just kind of their jewel. But it functions as their crown.
Yeah. It's like always glowing.
Yeah. It was this jewel it has this super cool strap, potentially even a mithril strap. And that's what the kings of Arnor wore on their forehead. So it has a strap around, and then it's got the jewel, and the jewel just shines, and it's this cool looking jewel. It reminds me of Eärendil as he wore the Silmaril as they sailed to Valinor, because that's what basically guided them through. So I think that's where they got the idea, because he's their ancestor, of course.
Okay.
But this was the crown of Arnor, because they don't actually have a crown. So, as stated, Isildur, he hangs out in Gondor to make sure everything's set up and good for about a year. During that year, the main bulk of his northern army has already marched up to Arnor, and they go by way of the Gap of Rohan, which isn't called Rohan yet. But we know what the Gap of Rohan is, right? We don't have to look at a map for this. It's near near Helm's Deep, you know, near Isengard. And they went up that way, okay? So the west side of the Misty Mountains. Now, Isildur, when he goes up, he wants to go to Rivendell first. So if you look at the big map of Lord of the Rings, it's always deceptive how curvy the Misty Mountains actually are. And so, you know, Rivendell, it's kind of at the peak or apex of kind of a bow, because the Misty Mountains kind of form a bow, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's actually quicker to not go through the Gap of Rohan, because then you have to backtrack towards Rivendell. It's quicker to kind of take the Fellowship route, marching up to Anduin, and then when you get past Lorien, at some point you turn west, cross the Misty Mountains, and then you're going to basically be at Rivendell, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they decide to do, because, one, his wife and his youngest son are still at Rivendell because they've been there for the duration of the whole war. And anyways, it seems the lands are much safer since Sauron's been defeated. And this is the way that the last alliance had come. So Isildur is pretty comfortable going the same way. With him are his three oldest sons. Why don't you take stabs at how to pronounce those names?
Elendur, Aratan, and Kirion.
Yeah, yeah. I gave them to you because they were easy.
Thanks.
And then also with him are 200 knights and soldiers. Okay, so 200, that's a pretty good number after peacetime.
Yeah, I was going to say, when I was sort of reading this paragraph, the descriptions were making it sound like Isildur was like feeling so confident that he was about to just march off by himself for 40 days like across this country that he had just helped conquer. And or just, you know, defeat the enemy from.
Yeah.
I was like, that's pretty risky.
I didn't see what I took issue was, wait, you can get from Minas Tirith to Rivendell in 40 days? How fast are you walking? You
know? Yeah.
But I guess it's reasonable. There's something, there was footnotes in this. I didn't actually read the footnotes this time through, but there's footnotes about how far they go each day, like the routine, okay. The marching routine. But yeah, I don't know. It's in Unfinished Tales. Read it for yourself if you're interested. So anyways, they come to the Gladden Fields. So this is north of Lorien. So I believe the Gladden Fields are the entire, it's not just something like along the river where it's kind of a marshy land. I believe it's the entire... I want to get a good look at it. You're not going to give me... Oh, there it is. Yeah, so I believe it's the entire region between... Plain region between the Anduin and Mirkwood.
Okay.
Okay, so north of Lorien, between the Anduin and Mirkwood, all of that is the Gladden Field. So it's literally a field, okay? It's not just something... some weird British word for field that really just means shoreline of the river. No, it's the entire expanse of that field. They're potentially even closer on to the Mirkwood side for some reason at that point, but who knows. You want to read that little bit right there? The fair day?
The fair day was waning. Above the distant mountains, clouds were gathering, reddened by the misty sun as it drew down towards them. The deeps of the valley were already in gray shadow. The Dunedain were singing, for their day's march was near its end, and three parts of the long road to Imladris was behind them. To their right, the forest loomed above them at the tops of steep slopes running down to their path, below which the descent into the valley bottom was gentler.
Mm.
Suddenly, as the sun plunged into the cloud, they heard the hideous cries of orcs, and saw them issuing from the forest and moving down the slopes, yelling their war cries. In the dimmed light, their number could only be guessed, but the Dunedain were plainly many times, even to 10 times, outnumbered. Isildur commanded Æthelngeir to be drawn up, a shield wall of 2 serried ranks that could be sent back at either end if outflanked, until at need it became a closed ring. If the land had been flat or the slope in his favor, he would have formed his company into a Durnaith, charged the orcs, hoping by the great strength of the Dunedain and their weapons to cleave a way through them and scatter them in dismay. But that could not now be done. A shadow of foreboding fell upon his heart.
All right, what do we think?
Brutal. I mean, all of a sudden, no bad news for a while, although there may be a little foreshadowing. But there's just making good time across this empty land, no more enemies, and then suddenly they're ambushed.
Yeah.
So it's pretty scary, pretty shocking.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like the detail. I don't know why. It's one of those details that I just love. But they're singing because, you know, they're three quarters done with the day as they march. And then I like this part too because finally I read all of Lord of the Rings, you know, and I'm just waiting for him to say something about it. And he doesn't, you know, we go to Rohan. This is clearly a northern people and he doesn't mention it at all. He doesn't mention it with Gondor until now. We get a shield wall. Thank God. There's no way he could go his whole legendarium stuff without mentioning a shield wall. Because shield wall, Vikings famously did shield walls all the time. They would call it a shield wall. And then The Spartans, if you watch the movie 300, they get into shield walls all the time as well. But then the most effective with it were the Romans, of course. And so, you know, high noble Gondor, they should be similar, at least in that regard, that they would be, you know, so orderly as the Romans that they could do a shield wall as well. So it's a good thing they did that. I'm kind of upset I didn't look up what a Durthane was. Actually, I'm gonna look it up now. I'm too interested.
I envisioned it as being something similar, but like in a marching format. Like,
yeah, it's something about all right, Durthane, man spearhead. Okay. Was a wedge formation launched over short distance against an enemy massing but not yet arrayed, or against a defensive formation on open ground. Okay, so a wedge-shaped shield wall. All right, good to know.
Okay.
All right, cool. All right, so yeah, so Isildur, he's speaking with his eldest son, which is Elendur, and they know that they're all surrounded. And they're very far from Lothlorien, they're very far from Moria, and they're very far from any help that they could find in Mirkwood. Okay, so all of these things are just out of range. The orcs were now drawing near. Isildur turned to his squire. Otar, he said, I give this now into your keeping. And he delivered to him the great sheath and the shards of Narsil, Elendil's sword. Save it from capture by all means that you can find, and at all costs. Even at the cost of being held a coward who deserted me. Take your companion with you and flee. Go, I command you. Then Otar knelt and kissed his hand, and the two young men fled down into the dark valley. All right, so this is how the broken sword's going to get away, and it's going to make its way to Rivendell, okay? Because Otar, it said the Esquire. Yeah, so Squire, Page, whatever you wanted to say. He gives it to him. He says, all right, get out of this battle. Make sure it gets to the north, you know, because this is such a great heirloom. We cannot lose this, no matter what, even if I'm going to be an idiot here, because we're outnumbered 10-1. Okay, so these two actually do get away. It seems like the orcs might just not have cared because they just want the big prize, you know. So they'll let a couple stragglers get out. Reward cowardice, apparently. So shield wall of Gondor, it repels the first attack from all these people, but the sun's almost setting, and so that's advantage orcs, you know. We saw that at Helm's Deep too. Aragorn was talking about how hopeful the dawn was going to be and stuff, and the orcs really like the darkness, right? Yeah. So Isildur, he gets his soldiers marching again, because they're just going to try to clear out. They're just going to try to keep moving, make headway, and he's going to hope that the orcs would only scout out behind them for some reason instead of full out attack them. But do you want to take what happens next?
There was not only cunning in the attack, but fierce and relentless hatred. The orcs of the mountains were stiffened and commanded by grim servants of Barad-dûr, sent out long before to watch the passes. And though it was unknown to them, the ring, cut from his black hand 2 years before, was still laden with Sauron's evil will and called to all his servants for their aid. The Dúnedain had gone scarcely a mile when the orcs moved again. This time they did not charge, but used all their forces. They came down on a wide front, which bent into a crescent and soon closed into an unbroken ring around the Dúnedain. They were silent now and kept at a distance out of the range of the dreaded steel bows of the Numenor. Though the light was falling, was fast failing, and Isildur had all too few archers for his need.
Okay, so Isildur's oldest son, Elendur, tells him to use the ring, because theoretically, shouldn't the orcs actually obey this thing, you know, if he commands them, if he's wearing the ring, right? But Isildur says, no, I cannot. I dread the pain of touching it, and I have not yet found the strength to bend it to my will. It needs one greater than I know myself to be. My pride has fallen. It should go to the keepers of the three.
Right. One little correction. It says it needs one greater than I now know myself to be.
Oh, I was trying to give more credit.
But I think that's significant, because he's like, he's acknowledging he's finally a little bit humble. Mm-hmm. Like, he was, when Elrond was telling him to destroy it, he was like, I'm keeping this thing.
Right.
And now, in his, like, basically, as he's seeing his death in front of him, he's like, I should have given this thing right away. Like,
right.
I need to give it to the keepers of the three, presumably, are the elves.
Right, correct. And he realizes, he's already saying it, the word pride. You know, he thought he was too good, too awesome, too worthy to, you know, mm-hmm. have the ring before. And now he's realizing, I bit off way more than I could chew taking this thing. You know, so, like, mm-hmm. this orc army attacking him so suddenly, so conveniently, it's probably because he has the ring. Like, that's mm-hmm. the kind of thing. Like, it attracts evil like this, right? So, you know, pride is famously, it's the most deadly of the deadly sins, seven deadly sins. And, yeah, you know, once again, it's biting at him. Who also suffered from pride throughout Lord of the Rings? Every single bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Melkor, Sauron, Fëanor, Ar-Pharazôn, you know, the list goes on mm-hmm. and on. It's like, pride, yep, this is the worst thing. We're getting this, we'll get beat over the head with that.
You know? mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As we should, you know, there's a reason. It keeps getting brought up, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You want to take the next part?
At that moment, there came a sudden blast of horns, and the orcs closed in on all sides, flinging themselves against the Dunedain with reckless ferocity. Night had come, and hope faded. Men were falling, for some of the greater orcs leaped up, two at a time, and dead or alive, with their weight, bore down a Dunedain, so that other strong claws could drag him out and slay him. The orcs might pay 5-1 in this exchange, but it was too cheap. Kirion was slain in this way, and Aratan mortally wounded, in an attempt to rescue him.
Alright, so those are the two younger sons, so they're basically dead. So then that oldest son, Elendur, he seeks out Isildur in the middle of this battle, and he tells him to escape with the ring, like how Otar did with the sword, so that he can bring it to those who hold the three rings. Because, you know, I mean, if the orcs actually capture this ring, that is really bad news again. You know, I mean, like, mm-hmm. they just got this away from Sauron 2 years ago. I mean, there's no way you can let the orcs get this back, because then they can find some sort of bad leader to give it to, right? Or
mm-hmm.
eventually it would just end up in a bad leader's hand somehow. So Isildur, this is kind of lame, but again, you have to understand that context, that it's of utmost importance the evil guys don't get the ring. He says, yeah, you know, I kind of hate to do it, but you're right, it's got to be done. Please forgive me and my pride that has brought all this about. So he understands this is totally his fault. He's an idiot. He screwed up big time, and now he has to run away like a coward, and I think that actually hurts him too. I was actually kind of wondering, well, come on, Isildur, what if you were a real man and you just gave up the ring to your son or something at this moment? But I guess not. Then again, maybe Tolkien already had it, you know, he already had Lord of the Rings published by the time of writing this, I believe, so he can't really undo and add a low-key, you know, whatever number ring bearer, sixth or seventh ring bearer, you know, because it goes mm-hmm. from Isildur to Deagle to Gollum to Frodo, or no, sorry, to Bilbo to Frodo to Sam for a little bit, you know, so I don't think you can really screw up that order. So anyways, mm-hmm. Isildur turned west, and drawing up the ring that had hung in a wallet from a fine chain about his neck, he set it upon his finger with a cry of pain, and was never seen again by any eye upon Middle-earth. But the Elendilmir of the West could not be quenched, and suddenly it blazed red and wrathful as a burning star. Men and orcs gave way in fear, and Isildur, drawing a hood over his head, vanished into the night. Okay, so it's painful when he puts on this ring, which means you really shouldn't have this thing.
mm-hmm.
The Elendilmir, that's the jewel that they wear as the crown of Arnor. It was apparently that couldn't really be turned invisible when you put on the ring. It just turned red, and then everybody saw it, and they were scared. What the hell is this, right? So he put, but he could put on a hood, and that somehow covered it up. That didn't really make sense to me.
Yeah,
but,
it's kind of a funny detail. It's like so an embarrassed teenager or something. Yeah. Like yanks his sweatshirt over his head.
Yeah, but that shouldn't. I don't understand why that works, because the Elendilmir, it's not turning invisible, but then when you put an invisible hood over it, it does. That's a. Whatever you say. Okay. All die, including Elendur, who they made noteworthy is the most like to Elendil. I kept wanting to say Elendil literally every time I just said his name for the past 15 minutes. Except there's one squire who's trapped under Elendur's body, because I believe he was Elendur's squire. And so he was hidden in the dead bodies, and he gets away. And then, of course, the two guys with the sword got away, the Otar and whoever... helper he had. So Isildur ran away, and he got all the way to the Anduin by midnight. So I think they said he went something like 20 miles maybe. All right, so if you look at the map again, they were in the middle of the field. Now they're on the Anduin itself. So he takes off all his armor and all his weapons except some short sword, and he jumps into the water to try to swim across. And he is a good swimmer, but the current is too strong. I'm going to leave it to you. You get to finish this off, Clifford.
And even as he felt the stream slacken and had almost won across, he found himself struggling among great rushes and clinging weeds. There, suddenly, he knew that the ring had gone. By chance, or chance well used, it had left his hand and gone where he could never hope to find it again. And so overwhelming was his sense of loss that he struggled no more, and would have sunk and drowned. But swift as it had come, the mood passed. The pain had left him. A great burden had been taken away. His feet found the riverbed, and heaving himself out of the mud, he floundered through the reeds to a marshy islet close to the western shore. There he rose up out of the water, only a mortal man, a small creature lost and abandoned in the wilds of Middle-earth. But to the night-eyed orcs that lurked there on the watch, he loomed up, a monstrous shadow of fear, with a piercing eye like a star. They loosed their poison arrows at it and fled. Needlessly, for Isildur, unarmed, was pierced through heart and throat, and without a cry, he fell back into the water. No trace of his body was ever found by elves or men. So passed the first victim of the malice of the Masterless Ring, Isildur, second king of all the Dunedain, lord of Anor and Gondor, and in that age of the world, the last.
So that's the end. Pretty bummer. So the ring obviously falls into the river.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most important part. And then we don't know what happens to his body.
It's like a super sad death. I even though I was feeling like he had it coming, because he's too prideful. He clearly missteps a little bit with the ring. This last moment, you're like, oh man, he's been redeemed. He's like kind of, he gets some forgiveness. Like the ring is gone. He lost it.
And yeah, but he ran away from a battle where three of his sons died.
Yeah, no, that's all that's bad. But it's I had hope that he was gonna be kind of like absolved of this momentarily, and then all of a sudden he's just killed blindly.
I thought it would have been cool if he had passed the ring to his oldest son, and it was the oldest son who just then it would have been really heartstring sad if he had been the one that was shot in the river. But Isildur had actually died gloriously in that last battle there. Or at least slightly gloriously, because it's his fault that the battle happened. But I don't know. I don't think you could. I don't think that would go too much against the accounts in Lord of the Rings. Plus, there is a last section of the story that we're not going to cover tonight. Maybe we'll get around to it. We probably won't. So this is really up to you. This whole chapter is the disaster of the Gladden Fields and Unfinished Tales. But there's too many spoilers, because you got to read the end of Lord of the Rings to finally get it. But they figure out a lot of, they really don't figure out the full answers until after many of the events of Lord of the Rings. Because then they actually get more information to piece it together how this would have happened. So maybe if we get to that part, if I remember to, it's really actually just going to be a question of me remembering, but... I'm not going to write it down. I'll just openly say that. I'm not going to write this detail down. Unless I already have it written down. But yeah, it's all there how they... Because the story... It's not like it matters. Tolkien could just write the story and that's that. But of course, this is Tolkien. So, you know, this is something that all the lure masters and the great scribes and historians, they figure out and piece it together, and they have their own accounts to put in their libraries and stuff. So how could you know that Isildur ran 20 miles to the river, swam all the way across to the other side, and then just randomly get shot by arrows right when he was almost about to get away? That's a pretty hard thing to come up with no eyewitness source, because they said nobody even saw him when this happened. But there are ways to piece it together. It's at the end of the chapter. We're just not going to go over it tonight. But yeah, I don't know. With that, we got another reasonably lengthed episode, thankfully.
<Yeah. laughs> Nice work.
Yeah. All right, so what I'm thinking for the next one we're going to do history of Arnor and Gondor. We're going to really try to blow through it. Hopefully it doesn't become obnoxious. Because I want to get them both in one shot. If we don't, you'll know. And then after that, we got the friendship of Rohan and Gondor. And then we jump back into Return of the King.
Okay, exciting.
Yeah. But yeah, we're
big things on the horizon.
Yeah, we've come a long way since in this mini season we've had with Faramir's rant to Finrod and Andreth to the Druidane to all the Numenor episodes through this. Yeah, this is pretty good. Yeah, if you don't have anything else, Clifford, I think we could call this a night.
Yeah, nothing here.
All right, thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, y'all.